and Tina visited Corinna repeatedly in the last year of her life, when she was 23. No matter what Donna said or did, Corinna would tell me that I should reach out to Donna, forgive Donna, Tina said. Because I knew it would mean a lot to Corinna, I actually called Donna and asked her to call Corinna and say that she loved her and that she was in her prayers, just to reach out to her before she died. Donna said, I don't think I can do that. Then she said, I know I haven't necessarily made good choices, but if I can make that up to you, tell me what I can do. And I said, if you call Corinna, all is forgiven and forgotten. She said, I've heard that she's prostituting, and I heard she was using drugs. And I said, first of all, you don't know if that's true or not. And secondly, what does it matter? She's dying. You don't have to call and talk about her life or what she's done. It would just mean a lot to her if you would call and say that you're praying for her, thinking of her, something, anything. She said, I don't know if I can do that. And she didn't. Tina enrolled in Columbia Law School, and as her accomplishments accrued, Donna began to seek her out. Donna called to ask whether she was going to be invited to see Tina graduate with honors. Tina said, I haven't talked to you in years, and the last time I talked to you, I made a request of you, and you couldn't even do that. So why are you trying to be a part of my life now? Tina became a public defender. Having accepted injustice from birth, she found solace in defending other people. When I met her, she was 7 months pregnant. I wondered whether she had fears about being a mother. Despite all the things that happened, in a lot of ways, I do feel very fortunate, very blessed, she said. My grandmother was able to give us so much love. Even though I was only with her for 8 years, she made such a huge impression. Tina was engaged to a man with a warm, supportive family, the exact opposite of mine. Her fiancé is naturally affectionate. And there are times when I'm suddenly like, every time you come in the room, you don't have to touch me. He knows how I'm damaged. Tina has worked hard to build a life that can subsume the past. I don't know what happened to Donna when I was conceived, she said. But that curse has run its course, and it's going to stop here. She rested a hand on her pregnant belly, as though to indicate how love, pushed away over and over again, had finally found its object. A woman who keeps a child conceived in rape has a permanent tie to her rapist. In some instances, hatred and fear keep the connection alive. In others, however, the mother is bracing herself for the possibility that either the rapist or the child might eventually seek out the other. Just as abused children cling to their abusive parents, driven by a biology beyond logic, so these women remain enthralled to their attackers, unable to break free of the terrible intensity of their connection. Unconditional rejection of the rapist, for them, feels too much like a rejection of the resultant child. If these women fail to experience the anger appropriate to being raped, they destroy themselves. If they evince such anger, they feel that they have failed their children. It's a more extreme version of a common challenge for people who have divorced. It can take a generation to transcend this ambivalence. One woman told me that when her child was born, she had the rapist's eyes. Her beautiful baby daughter has her eyes, this woman said. Now, they're the family eyes, not the eyes of the man who raped me. The grimmest challenge for many of these women comes if the rapist or his family tries to gain access to the child. Men who have gotten away with rape seldom retreat in shame or repentance. They sometimes play out their ghoulish exuberance by laying claim to their progeny. In instances where charges were never filed, the threat of joint custody is real. Stigma, Inc., the online support group for people conceived in rape and incest, had a posting saying, "The father rapist is thus deemed ineligible for visitation or custody of the minor child." However, as in the case of rape victims in general, the burden of proof that a rape took place is often placed upon the woman who has suffered the crime. Often, it comes down to a he said, she said issue. When Emily Barrett would hug her mother, Flora, she was always pushed away. "But it took a minute for her to realize that she wanted to shoo me off," Emily told me, "and I missed those moments right before she did." Flora was a light-skinned Jamaican woman who had emigrated to New York for a better life. By the time Emily was 12, Flora was on her fourth husband. "She was extremely charismatic and beautiful, and she was funny," Emily said. "Other people loved her. She was a hypocrite, but it was still interesting to watch, almost like a science project." As an only child, Emily was lonely. Her father, Phil, did not live in the household, but Emily saw or spoke to him every day until she was 11, when he suddenly disappeared. No one would tell her what had happened, so she assumed he was dead. Before she turned 13, she developed a crush on a good-looking 19-year-old, Blake. He took to giving her rides to and from school, and one day in the car, he leaned over and kissed her. As the years passed, her attachment to him grew. When she was 15, Emily gave him her virginity, even though she knew he had a girlfriend. That same year, Emily answered the phone one day, and it was her father, from whom she'd heard nothing for 4 long years. He told her to get together all the money she could and meet him at Grand Central Station. Emily headed for the station with $200. Phil appeared abruptly, yanked Emily behind a pillar, took the money from her, and jumped onto a train. Emily was shattered and tried to kill herself. "My mind went on some sort of carnival ride," she said, "and at the end of it was a whole medicine cabinet." Her mother took her to the emergency room. "I didn't know how to explain it other than to say, my dead father jumped out of Grand Central Station. They really thought I was crazy." The resident psychiatrist kept Emily on the ward for 23 days, then advised Flora that Emily needed therapy. 3 weeks after her release, Flora moved to Virginia, taking her reluctant daughter with her. "My mother dealt with problems by running away, and her idea of therapy was to buy a new house," Emily said. In Virginia, Emily's mother found her a job doing bookkeeping for friends who owned a restaurant. Emily called them Uncle Eric and Aunt Suzette. Uncle Eric asked Emily to help out his brother, who owned a store, and the brother raped her after driving her to work. "It's not like on television," Emily said. "There's no black eye, and there's no knives and guns. It's 5 seconds. I was just stunned." She spent the next few days in a haze, then finally called the police, by which time the man had fled. In the weeks that followed, Emily had severe headaches, and her breasts began to hurt. When Flora found out Emily was pregnant, she locked the doors and unplugged the phones while she decided what to do about it. "She told the school I had appendicitis," Emily said. "Every day she would come home and just scream, and then I'd hear her in her room crying and wailing in her shower. Then Uncle Eric and Aunt Suzette were coming over saying how I'm ruining their reputation. I was 16, and I had no business having a child. But that whole experience was just insanity." Flora finally took Emily to a clinic for an abortion. Emily had been educated in Catholic schools, even though her family wasn't Catholic, because Flora thought it was a better education. Emily had been confirmed in the faith. Now she was afraid she would burn in hell. She shared her regrets with the clinician, so he sent her home. "That ride home with my mother was one of the worst experiences of my life," she recalled. Flora said that if Emily had really been raped, she wouldn't care about losing the baby, and when they got home, she arranged an abortion at another clinic. Emily's pregnancy was terminated 5 days later. For a long time, I would calculate in my mind and imagine how old that baby would be from when I was 16, Emily said. I would see a baby and start to cry. Aunt Suzette had assured Emily that the rapist had left the country, but Emily thought she saw him everywhere. I was in a panic, Emily said, and one day I was walking from the bathroom to the kitchen, and my mother whispered in my ear, "This never happened." And that was it. It was like a switch went off in my head. I never talked about it again. I tried never to think about it again. And eventually, it just sort of dissolved into my mind. As abruptly as Flora had relocated to Virginia, she moved back to New York. For a few years, life returned to normal. Emily resumed her friendship with Blake. She went off to college, but dropped out to take care of her mother after Flora was diagnosed with advanced colon cancer. Flora left Emily a small inheritance. In an eerie echo of Emily's final encounter with her father, she soon got a call from Blake asking for an urgent loan. She gave him $5,000, and he vanished. Emily located him after a few years and asked about the loan. He said that he had some money to give her and told her to come over to collect it. "He gave me a drink with something in it," Emily said. "Next thing I know, I feel my clothes coming off. I'm seeing flashing lights and pictures. He was positioning my body. He was moving me around. I couldn't believe it. When I woke up, he was in the shower, and I was shaking." Emily gathered her clothes and drove home. She was dating a policeman at the time, and when she told him what had happened, he took her to the precinct to report it. Blake was arrested, and the bringing of charges began. "They told me not to contact him, but I needed to know, I wanted to know, why? I had known Blake for so long, and he had been my best friend." She called him, and he refused to talk because of the restraining order. Then he called her back and begged her not to go through with the charges. Emily sensed that she was pregnant, but couldn't face it. She took 7 pregnancy tests, hoping that eventually one would be negative. She broke up with the policeman, her emotional life centered on Blake, the rape, and the pregnancy. At a hearing in her suit against him, when she realized that he might go to prison, she told the assistant district attorney during a recess that she couldn't see it through because she was pregnant by Blake. The attorney asked for a continuance, and Emily left the courthouse. "Blake ran after me and asked, 'What's going on?' And I told him, got in the car, made this crazy U-turn, and I drove." Blake first convinced Emily not to have an abortion. Then he said, "I didn't want my child to have its father in prison," she remembered. "What are you going to tell it when it asks you where I am?" he said. The question brought up Emily's pain about her father's disappearance. "I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I was losing it," she told me. Eventually, she told the ADA that she would not go forward with the rape case. She asked Blake to leave her alone. "But he just kept checking in with me, I guess to make sure that I didn't change my mind. When I was 5 months and a week pregnant, he told me that he was with another woman, that she was 5 months pregnant, and that she was moving in with him. Though Emily had not imagined building a life with him, she was crushed. At the time, Emily was working at a daycare center. "I was a very happy, fun person," she said. "I was around kids all the time, and they were my life. But when I was at home, I turned off the lights, I came upstairs, and I just cried until 6:45 the next morning, when it was time to start work." Then Delia was born. She was like a salve, like a panacea, which is a lot of responsibility for a newborn, Emily said. She began to think about the blank line on Delia's birth certificate, the one for the second parent, and she decided to add Blake's name in case Delia ever needed another close genetic relative for a medical emergency. What Emily hadn't considered was that Blake would be notified, and when she went to the courthouse to pick up the revised document, he was there. A judge granted him visitation rights. "I realized he's going to be tied to me for the rest of my life," Emily said. "I didn't sleep for days before his first visit." So began an uneasy détente. Blake paid child support and saw Delia erratically for 2 years, then drifted away again. "I was so attached to Delia that I couldn't let go at all," Emily said. "When she was small, she was like a toy, so cute, all huge cheeks. But when she was about 4, she started asking me questions about her father and where she came from, and it was like someone took a hammer and cracked me open, and I spilled out all over the room." By then, Emily was running a group of daycare centers. "And one day, I just stopped," she said, "like a clock stops working." She began having panic attacks, blackouts, olfactory hallucinations, and sudden flashes of disorientation. Her hair was falling out. Her doctor attributed the symptoms to stress and advised psychiatric counseling. He said he wanted me to speak to somebody, and he was going into his office to find some names of people he'd recommend, she said. "I don't remember anything after that, until I was in my office at school, and my phone was ringing, and my assistant was banging on my door." She said, "Miss Emily? Miss Emily? Your doctor's been calling here for an hour. He said that you left your coat and shoes, and are you okay?" Emily looked down and saw that she was in wet stockings. It was snowing outside. Emily became intensely agoraphobic and lost her job. "I don't remember how Delia got food," she said. "It got done. I couldn't leave the house except to go to therapy. Then I couldn't leave the room. I wasn't sleeping for days at a time. I was fragmenting." A psychiatrist put her on antidepressants, and she did constant talk therapy with him, and she gradually began to reemerge. "He saved me," she said. Just as she was getting it together, Blake turned up at the front door to say that he wanted to see Delia. The familiar cycle recurred. He would come occasionally to visit, then vanish, over and over. Emily decided she had to be strong for Delia and not keep her from her father, but Blake's motives always seemed unclear. "I didn't know what to do, because he was her father and she knew it," Emily said. "If something happened to me, he could get her. So I had to make sure he wouldn't hurt her, and the only way to do that was to let him know her, so he would care about her." Blake's attention was never reliable. When he wasn't around, Delia sometimes said to me, "I wish I had my daddy here," Emily recalled. He'd be gone a year, and then he would show up. She would ask where he is, and I'd say, "He's working, maybe," or, "He'll come when he has time," or, "Let's do something instead." I redirected her for years and years, and every time she asked, I started cascading down a hill again. At 7, Delia broke her leg and began crying for her father. So Emily called Blake. He returned the call 5 months later and started coming over again. Emily had had a brief romance and given birth to a son, Gideon, 7 years younger than Delia. Blake told Emily that she belonged to him and that her new child was a betrayal. The sexual brutality his argument implied frightened her, and she decided to flee, so she moved the kids back to Virginia. When I met Emily, Delia was 10 and had recently won a National Academic Award and matriculated in a magnet school for gifted children. She's never asked me about how she came to exist, and I know she wonders, her mother said. She and I have had conversations about my prickliness, how I pull away. I would never, ever, ever tell her that it has anything to do with her. I always tell her that it's because of me, and because my mom pulled away from me. But I don't do it with her brother. Emily had recently become engaged, and she told me that her fiancé, Jay, found this coldness toward Delia upsetting. Emily could not bring herself to tell him about Delia's origins in rape. "Fix me," Emily said to me as we sat on the floor of her office late at night doing this interview. "Why can't I hug my daughter? I love her, but when she touches me, it feels like hundreds of razor blades scraping across my skin, like I'm going to die. I understand that I just have to let her because she's a child, and so I do. But in my mind, I go someplace else, and I know that she knows it. So now she asks permission. I prepare myself. There are rules, like she can't come up behind me because her father had this stealth ability to just appear in front of you, and you don't know where he came from. She inherited that. It has been hard working around so large a secret. She wrote me a really sad letter 1.5 years ago, Emily said. It said, "This little girl misses New York. This little girl misses her father." When Jay accompanied Emily and her 2 kids to New York for the funeral of a family friend, he encouraged her to contact Blake for Delia's sake. So she did, arranging for them to spend an afternoon together. When he came to pick her up, he met Jay. The episode proved to be a turning point for Emily. "As soon as I got back to Virginia, my pregnancy, the incident, it all came into my brain and my body at the same time," Emily said. She finally told Jay the truth, and he was shocked. "She looks like Blake in some ways, but not as much as she did when she was small," Emily added. "She reminds me of me, and I attempt to focus on that. Even if I don't always love myself, I can love myself in her. But there's that other part that makes me struggle every single day. Because while most mothers just go with their natural instincts, my instincts are horrifying. It's a constant, conscious effort to keep my instincts from taking over." The idea of rape within marriage was introduced in the late 1970s by Diana E. H. Russell, who maintained that 14% of married women had been raped by a husband. In the late 80s and early 90s, the marital exception to rape laws was gradually removed from the books in most states, despite spirited protests from the political right, including some who claimed, echoing the misogyny of the colonial era, that accusations of rape within marriage would be used by vengeful wives to persecute innocent husbands. Instead, marital rape most commonly comes up in court within a larger pattern of domestic violence. Cases such as the 1989 Burnham case, in which a woman accused her husband of 70 counts of rape, were instrumental in this shift. Victor Burnham had over many years subjected his wife Rebecca to beatings, being struck by gun butts, being held at gunpoint, being threatened with death, being tied up and raped, being forced to solicit strange men for sexual threesomes, being photographed in pornographic poses, being shocked with a cattle prod, and being forced to have sex with the family dog. The trial included both pictorial evidence and sworn testimony from men who had been invited by Burnham to have sex with his wife and declined, recognizing Rebecca's fear. Louise McCormand Plummer, co-author of Real Rape, Real Pain, and herself a rape survivor, wrote, "The woman raped by her partner was routinely blamed and told that since her rapist was her partner, it wasn't real rape. Women such as myself were being told that our pain was an overreaction. The fact of being in a relationship meant that any sexual rights were void." Ashley Green is blonde, slender, and fragile as a reed. She radiates a longing for protection. Growing up with poor white parents in western Pennsylvania, where her father worked intermittently as a coal miner, she had little of it. Both parents were negligent, physically abusive drug users. When Ashley's father despaired of finding work, they moved to Florida. Ashley would often come home from school to find her depressed mother lying on the floor exactly where she had lain in the morning. Ashley was never sure whether there would be food to eat or when the electricity was going to be disconnected again. She had just turned 16 when she met 35-year-old Martin at a party. During the next year, he accompanied Ashley to church, paid for her to attend volleyball camp, suggested that he would get her a car. She already had a 19-year-old boyfriend, but she did not discourage Martin's friendship, which was non-sexual in a way characteristic of men who are grooming a victim. Martin eventually said that he needed to hire someone to clean his apartment and suggested that Ashley take the job. "I cleaned for a couple of hours, thought I had done a good job," and he said, "You need to do it again. This isn't clean enough," and was very harsh with me. He offered her liquor. Once she was drunk, he sodomized her twice, anally. In retrospect, the situation was clear to Ashley. He knew what he had, a kid who wasn't being watched, who really wanted out of a very hostile and unpredictable home, she said. He had food and transportation, these things my parents weren't going to provide. He had a nice apartment and a good job. These advantages seemed like a step forward. So Ashley broke up with her boyfriend, dropped out of high school, and moved in with Martin. He turned out to be a drug user, like her parents. At 17, she became pregnant. Martin grew increasingly violent as the pregnancy progressed, beating Ashley so severely that she twice ran away to a shelter for battered women. Once he stabbed her and she nearly died. "I was afraid he was either going to kill our child from beating me or take her from me when she was born," Ashley said. "I used to think if I could just take her from my stomach and hide her somewhere, maybe she would be born alive. I would pray, 'God, if you let my baby live, I'll be a good mother.'" In deference to her religious grandmother, Ashley married Martin just before their daughter was born. The beatings had put her repeatedly in preterm labor, a dangerous condition that can be brought on by stress. She held the pregnancy through multiple bouts, but when she felt the baby was really coming, she asked Martin to drive her to the hospital. He detoured to buy cocaine on the way, and Ashley arrived too late to receive licit drugs to blunt the pain of delivery. Ashley instinctively loved her newborn girl, Sylvia, but had no idea what to do as a mother. "I was afraid of her. She was very colicky and very temperamental and cried day and night," Ashley remembered. The beatings continued, and sometimes Ashley could barely move. Ashley's aunt had persuaded her to report the abuse, so Martin moved them all to Alabama, beyond the reach of Florida law. When Sylvia was 5 months old, Ashley escaped with her to a shelter in Florida. They were allowed to stay for 30 days, and during that time Ashley got a driver's license, a car, and a job, arranged to stay with someone from her church until she found an apartment, and filed for divorce. When the baby would fall asleep, Ashley remembered, "I'd thank God I had her for one more day." As the months passed, however, Ashley increasingly doubted her ability to take care of Sylvia on her own. When she worked, she lost food stamp eligibility. Sylvia was getting sick frequently, so they needed better health insurance. So Ashley became a welfare mom, which meant better health care, but not enough money for rent. After a desperate year, she went back to Martin. "The day I packed my stuff, I still believed that he would get help and be okay," she said, "and we would be a family." Instead, Martin assaulted her sexually, then took Sylvia and sued for divorce. Ashley didn't see her daughter for 3.5 months. Eventually, she was granted joint custody, contingent on her continuing to live in Alabama. "It was like being held hostage," she said. Martin made a big show of his mistreatment of Sylvia. He pulled up one day, and there was marijuana smoke rolling out of the car. "He actually tried to French kiss her in front of me when she was 3. She would come home with big bruises and knocks on her head." Sylvia's underlying personality did not make things easier. "She was a very unhappy little baby, and I felt such guilt," Ashley said. "I was afraid to even bathe her, like her genital area. I was afraid I would do something because of the abuse I'd grown up with. She threw tantrums and pulled my hair out. She bloodied my nose one time. I got her a kitten when she was 2. She would take that cat by the back legs and throw it on the couch, and she would sit on it and pull its whiskers out. I don't know if it's the violence that she's seen, the violence that's happening to her ongoing, what happened while she was still inside me and I was getting beat up, or if she was just born like him." Ashley felt powerless. "When she was 5, I was bathing her one day in the tub with me, and she told me that her dad and her did the same thing. I called a therapist, and she said, 'Don't ask her any more questions. Just bring her in.' It was worse than I had thought. The psychologist said that he was not only bathing with her, but he was having her wash his genitals and doing things around her private area." Ashley filed for a protective order. Martin brought a countersuit seeking exclusive custody on grounds that Ashley was lying. Ashley had a clean record. Martin had previous convictions for drug possession and for beating Ashley, and had been put in court-ordered therapy for violence. In the Alabama courts, however, he won. After the ruling, Ashley attempted suicide. Sylvia later complained to Ashley that Martin had walked in on her naked, climbed in the shower with her, hit her, and denied her food and medical care. Ashley returned to court and sued for custody again, appearing before the same judge. "I had tape-recorded phone conversations of her telling me about all this abuse, but he didn't allow me to play them. Instead, he ordered I would have to pay all of my husband's legal bills, $14,000. Now I'm terrified they're going to put me in jail." She finally gave up on her daughter. "It's just too much trauma," Ashley said. "It's not that I don't love her. It's not that I don't want her to be free from that. It's that for whatever reason, God has seen fit for her to be there. God has seen fit for us not to have a relationship, and I've done everything I can do." At 26, Ashley decided to go to college. She graduated with a 3.8 average and became a qualified community counselor. Like Marina James, Brenda Enriquez, Lisa Boynton, and Tina Gordon, Ashley has helped herself by helping others. But she has worked with offenders, not just with victims. Most of them, the higher functioning ones, were very socially skilled. They seemed like the nicest people you could ever meet, some of them. They're very socially skilled and they make people very comfortable, and that's how they accomplish what they do, and that's how they keep their victims quiet. So I learned a great deal when I was there, and did a lot of healing of my own, and I think helped other people heal, offenders heal. Eventually, she met a man with whom she bore another daughter, in a consensual, child-wanting, of-age, in-love relationship. Alicia was born with profound hearing loss in her left ear. Her acquisition of speech was delayed and her articulation poor. After she was diagnosed with other delays, her father left, unable to cope. She's a special needs child, and that can be very trying at times, but I have very different feelings for Alicia versus Sylvia, Ashley said. I think she's the reason I graduated with my bachelor's, and the reason I lived. Still, the shadow of Sylvia's deterioration loomed, especially when Alicia reached the age at which Sylvia had been taken away from her mother. I looked at her last night. She was sleeping, and she looked a little bit like Sylvia, and I had to turn my head because I'm afraid she's going to die or I'm going to lose custody of her. I think this is the time to talk about statutory rape and how damaging it is, the injustice of having a child with an adult more than twice my age. I know that probably doesn't sound as serious as some stranger holding you down and forcibly raping you, but it has been for me and for our child, who will never be okay. Statutory rape is a category that has often been abused. Someone I interviewed was arrested when he was found having sex with his girlfriend, who was 6 months younger than he, and under age 17 to his legally adult 18, even though his girlfriend's parents approved of the relationship. The principle that no one over the age of 18 should ever be allowed to have carnal relations with anyone under the age of 18 can be hard to defend in such circumstances. It is nonetheless evident that in many situations, statutory rape is rape. The influence men such as Martin can have over young girls who have been neglected or ill-treated by their own parents is difficult to exaggerate. At 14, Sylvia appeared destroyed by her young lifetime of abuse. She dresses like a boy, Ashley said. You can't really tell that she's a girl. She's filthy, and she smells horrible. She has psychotic-type symptoms. Talking about it, Ashley began to cry, then to stutter. Apologizing, she said, The last visit I had with her, she told me she heard voices. One of the things that she talked about was her dad would come while she was changing clothes or showering, which is why now she doesn't shower and doesn't change her clothes. Ashley is unable to work because she is taking care of Alicia full-time. She lives on less than $300 a month in an income-based apartment. Although she no longer sees Sylvia, she still pays child support to her one-time rapist out of the child support that she gets for Alicia. She has taken down all the pictures of Sylvia. I have physical scars on my body from his abuse of me, Ashley said. He's made her into another scar. I can't even stand to look at her. I would welcome her with open arms, I would go to therapy with her, but I would probably not let her in my home. I would be afraid she would abuse Alicia. I wish I had never had her. If I could go back, I would have aborted, or I would have given her up for adoption. It hasn't been fair to me, and it hasn't been fair to her. A recent study has identified coerced childbearing as a weapon in the arsenal of power and control. Numerous women who have been raped within relationships speak of the rape as a means used by a man to keep her under his thumb, the classic ploy of domination by keeping a wife barefoot and pregnant. Women in surveys have variously said, "He raped me to keep me pregnant all the time because he knew I would never leave the kids." And, "They own you when you have a child by him. Part of the purpose in having a baby is to control you." As the mother's children bear witness to ongoing sexual violence, they are more likely to be traumatized and to be both victims of and perpetrators of sexual abuse themselves. Although no one ever deserves to be raped, a woman's actions can have an enormous impact on her own safety. Yet some women repeatedly put themselves in situations of extreme vulnerability. Most of us anticipate bad things that could happen, but some are capable of reacting only to events that have already occurred. Talking to many women who had borne children of rape, I was struck by their inability to foresee the likelihood of danger inherent in their choices. Every bad thing that befell them, even at the hands of previous aggressors, came as a surprise. They could not tell the difference between people who warranted trust and those who didn't. They lacked guiding intuition and were blind to bad character until it manifested itself. Nearly all such women I met had not been cherished or protected as children. At the most basic level, they did not know what caring behavior felt like, so they were unable to recognize it. Some were desperate for love and attention, which made them easy targets. Most were so familiar with neglect or abuse that they accepted it when it came their way. For many, abuse was synonymous with intimacy. Some who actively strove to improve their situation found themselves merely repeating their past. They kept falling back into the familiar muck. It is difficult to imagine who Mindy Woods might be if her uncle had not started molesting her when she was 10. He lived next door in their small town in the Midwest. He molested her older sister for 9 years, and Mindy every week or so for 7, sometimes while his own young daughters were in the room. He started in with their cousin when she was a small child, but she put a stop to it at 13 when she filed a police report. A detective came over to interview Mindy, but she clammed up. Her uncle negotiated a plea bargain, resulting in nothing more than community service and a fine. "My grandma saw it," Mindy recalled, "and she used to call my sister and me sluts. 10-year-old sluts, quite a concept." In pictures of Mindy from third grade, she's a little slip of a girl. The next year, after the abuse began, she was twice as heavy, and by her senior year of high school, she weighed 275 pounds. Mindy went off to college, but came home after 3 months. At 21, she married the first guy that ever let me cry all night and just held me. She tried to have children, but was unable to conceive and could not find sexual satisfaction in her marriage. She divorced at 25 and traveled around the country with a truck driver she met on the internet, eventually getting a trucker's license herself. Seeking to be subjugated by powerful masters, she entered into the world of BDSM, bondage, discipline, sadomasochism. "My uncle made me this way. He molded me sexually," she said. "I don't think it's wanting to be a victim again. I think it's more analyzing. I want to figure out what I was feeling, what was going through my mind, and why the hell I let him do it." BDSM relationships are supposed to be guided by mutuality, The slave consents to be led by her master, who putatively treats her with respect even as he commands her behavior. Seeking such a master, Mindy met a man from Michigan online. He turned out to be a psychopath. You can be somebody who punishes somebody, who sets down rules and expects you to obey them, and still be a loving person, Mindy said. There's a difference between punishment and abuse. A master is supposed to have love and respect for the submissive. It's called a gift of submission. The Michigander had erectile dysfunction owing to diabetes and never had intercourse with her. Instead, he raped her with objects, including a broomstick. He kept her locked in the house and told her that the neighbors were paid to call him if she tried to leave. It took her 3 months to escape. She was able to get online long enough to find a place set up to rescue submissives who needed help, and the people there took her to a safe house. When she left the safe house, she went to stay with a friend, Mamie, who was getting ready to be married and had asked Mindy to be her maid of honor. Mamie was pregnant and living with her fiancé, who was flirtatious in what Mindy took to be a friendly way. It was in front of his wife-to-be, and she laughed, Mindy said, so I thought it was okay. Mindy came down with a bad flu shortly after she arrived and started taking codeine cough syrup. She woke one night, groggy and confused, to find Mamie's fiancé having sex with her, whispering in her ear that he was going to make her pregnant. I thought it was some weird nightmare from the codeine, she said. Mindy had learned with her uncle how to pretend that sexual assaults were not happening, and she woke up the next day and went about her business as usual. The second time, he put a pillow over her face to prevent her from crying out. The third time, Mamie walked in just as he was finishing up, and her fiancé said that he had been giving Mindy a massage for her back problems. Mindy remained mute and submissive. I was just so afraid, Mindy said. He knew I was extremely vulnerable, and he knew that I didn't prosecute my uncle, and I didn't prosecute the idiot in Michigan. He knew my history of just letting things drop. Mindy stayed on at the house and was maid of honor at the wedding. When she got home, Mindy went to her gynecologist and said she had been raped. She found out that she was pregnant. I didn't have the money to get an abortion myself, she said. I knew my parents would have shunned me if they'd found out. My mom is a born-again Christian, so if I still wanted to be in the family, I needed to keep the kid. Mindy went into a severe depression, and the fibromyalgia from which she had long suffered began to escalate, putting her in constant pain. If I had not been pregnant, I probably would have killed myself, she recalled. I've thought about suicide my whole life, ever since my uncle. When she was 4 months along, Mindy met Larry Foster, and she was still with him 4 years later when I was introduced to her. He knew everything before he decided to move in with me, Mindy told me. He was in the delivery room when she gave birth to Gretel and put his name on her birth certificate. Mindy was relieved when she had a girl. I haven't had very good luck with males, she said. Mindy, who weighs over 300 pounds, wears both the collar of her submission to Larry and a pentacle that signifies her Wiccan belief system. I'm not Miss Betty Crocker or Martha Stewart or a neat freak who bakes and has dresses, like his mom and grandma, but they're relatively accepting, she said. Still, she feels unequal to motherhood. Part of being a mom is actually exerting a little authority over a kid. I'm submissive. I have no authority. Having your mother in a dog collar, obeying orders, does not necessarily help build a little girl's self-esteem. Mindy sometimes calls Larry Master around the house. Gretel calls him Daddy. I would get upset with her if she called him Larry, just the same as I would get upset with her if she called him Master. And to me, that's just a normal parent thing, Mindy said. She thinks she will eventually have to tell Gretel about her biological father. But for now, I want her to just know Larry as Daddy. Mindy takes medication for depression, diabetes, and fibromyalgia. It's hard for me sometimes to get my mind clear enough to form a sentence, she said. There are times I can't pick Gretel up. I'll sit down, and she'll crawl up in my lap, but if she starts squirming around, I can't take it. That's driving a wedge between her and me. The relationship with Gretel has some of the same quality of resignation that typifies Mindy's submissive relationships with men. She is a constant reminder, Mindy said. She's annoying, but what three-year-old isn't? There have been a lot of times that I've wanted to drop her off at a street corner somewhere and leave. I want to blame the fact that I don't have a life on her. Then I think about it, and I do have a life. My life is her. And once I get into that mentality, I love her to death. Then in the next breath, Mindy added, I still wish I'd miscarried and didn't have her. Mindy writes poetry and fiction based in the BDSM world, almost all of it about young girls being brutally ravaged by older men. For Mindy Woods, there is always something beautiful in ruthlessness. It repels and compels her, and she writes of cruelty with hapless pleasure. I even cry about some of the stuff I write, Mindy said. It's hard not to see elements of both Mindy and Gretel in the little girls who are tortured in these stories. Hard not to see Mindy's anger and ambivalence toward her daughter as anger at her own young self that allowed the original abuse. Mindy inhabits a world where choice and helplessness are impossibly blurred. Many of the women I interviewed who are raising children born as a result of rape have emerged from trauma into at least superficially ordinary lives. Others, such as Mindy, remain at the outer margins. Mindy represents the weirdness into which a woman can descend after childhood sexual abuse. Some women are damaged in ways that make them deeply alien. They manifest their scars by vanishing into netherworlds as sordid and disturbing as the events they have survived. Damage has lasting consequences. Many parents and children I met who had coped with the obstacles associated with exceptional differences wanted to affirm their positive experiences and stand as models for others. Many had emerged from difficulty as better people and were eager to share their triumphs. By contrast, the mothers of children conceived in rape sought validation. Even if they had built fulfilling parental bonds, their child's identity had not transformed them. Most children of rape know that. They sense the festering penumbra of loss that shrouds them even before they slip into the world. Someone who does not share the defining condition might disavow the stigma attached to deafness or dwarfism without compunction, but it is almost inconceivable not to be repulsed by rape, and that taint haunts raped women and their rape-conceived children. Who, in this age of genetic determinism, could announce that his father was a rapist and not expect some degree of disquiet to ensue? Even if being a child of rape may never become a celebrated identity, it may become a more socially accepted one, thanks to the improved educational, legal, and psychological handling of rape in recent decades. The less forbidden a topic rape is, and the more easily its survivors can reach one another, the greater the likelihood that mothers and children will find the horizontal communities they need. Even without such support, some women manage to harness their trauma to good parenting, and a few even believe that reckoning with shocking violence has made them better parents than any less fearful history would have done. Barbara Schmitz grew up on a farm in northern Nebraska in the 1970s. My main memories of my childhood are being afraid and being very, very lonely, she said. Her brother Jim and sister Elaine were 5 and 7 years older, respectively, and her school had only 10 students, just one of them her age. Her mother was violent and unpredictable. She used to beat Jim with a wooden hanger, and I'd be down at the end of the hallway feeling helpless. When I got to the age where I could outrun her, she would torture my dog and cat in front of me to make me come back, because she knew that I would rather be beaten myself than have my animals hurt. Even my animals, that I loved, were used against me. Her father was sexually abusive. She remembers his exposing his erect penis to her. Other memories are hazier and more sinister. Once Elaine and Jim started high school, she and her father were often alone at home in the afternoons. My dad had a room in his basement with this creaky old cot, and I have memories of lying on that cot, knowing the door was locked and my dad being there. There was a window above my head, and I would picture myself turning into a white bird and flying out through that window. Her vaginal area was chronically inflamed, and her mother told her to put chapstick on it. When Barbara was 13, her mother got her a spaghetti strap dress for a wedding, and Barbara had put it on and was sitting on the kitchen counter talking to her mother. My dad got up and went into the bathroom down the hall, and when I looked, he was standing there with an erection. I turned to my mom and she said, "Cover yourself up." So my mom knew. Barbara recalled getting a particularly bad beating from her mother when she was 9 or 10. I was down on the floor, and she had these orthopedic shoes, and she was kicking my head. I bit her ankle and went running down to the basement because I knew where my dad kept the pistol. And she came after me. She had fists and this rage on her face. And then she saw the gun, and her face just went from rage to fear. I remember saying, "If you come one step closer, I will shoot you." She turned around and went back upstairs. After her mother would beat Barbara, she would make brownies. That was her way of apologizing, Barbara remembered. And if I didn't eat them, that meant that I didn't love her. So I got fat. Elaine is very pretty and thin and always had the new clothes, and I was always wearing the hand-me-downs. My mom dressed her up and let her be a cheerleader and in Girl Scouts. But Elaine was nice to me. The few times I remember being tucked into bed and hugged, it was Elaine who did it. Barbara's best friend was her border collie, Pumpkin. Her father would make her beat the animal with a whip, and when Pumpkin had puppies, when Barbara was 9, he put them in a gunny sack with a brick and threw them in the creek. Barbara used to climb the hill behind the house and seek out tranquility and peace. "I would talk to God a lot," she recalled. "I'd be like, 'Why are you letting this happen to me?" I was pissed at him for a long time. She remembers herself as a mean little kid who would cut off her doll's heads and kick her older sister for no reason. It was okay to be angry in my family. It was not okay to cry. When she started to weep after spraining her ankle as a teenager, her father slapped her repeatedly, telling her to shut up. Barbara longed for approval. You know how a dog would rather be beaten just to get attention that way than be ignored? So she started lifting 50-pound bags of seed corn and doing other heavy farm chores. By way of reward, her father taught her how to play poker and how to fish. Barbara finally escaped by going to college in Lincoln. During rush week for fraternity and sorority candidates, Barbara went to a big party, and a guy who seemed nice invited her over to see his